So last time we left off talking about core collapse supernova, so massive stars that get to the end of their lifetimes. And when they try to fuse iron in the core, they can't, because iron can't be fused into something more massive and generate energy at the same time, and so the star loses the ability to support itself and collapses in on itself and explodes. And so I wanted to spend the day today sort of talking about what the potential products of that supernova explosion are. So one of those, we sort of alluded to this last time, is the neutron star. So a neutron star is a very dense, compact object, sort of at the extreme of what in the density and size of a massive object can be, without becoming a black hole, which we'll also talk about today. But this is basically the leftover neutron core after the iron and helium photodissociate into just neutrons, basically, which then is stopped by the neutron degeneracy pressure as it collapses in on itself. So this is just the leftover core of the star that exploded. But it's made of mostly just neutrons. Because these have to come from stars that are 8 solar masses or up, the mass of the core remnant that's left over is going to be a significant fraction of the leftover remaining bit of the star. So neutron stars are going to have masses between 1.5 and 3 solar masses. The 3 is sort of a hard limit. If you go try to go above 3, then you end up with a black hole instead. We'll talk about that's because the neutron degeneracy pressure can't support that gravity force anymore, and it loses the ability. And there's nothing past neutron degeneracy pressure. It just collapses down even further. The size of these are, 10, 15-ish kilometers. So to human scale, that's about the size of the island of Manhattan, New York City. Or if you want to think about it in local terms, about the distance from here to downtown. Ish. Maybe Coventry Road. Ballpark. So that's not very big on astronomical scales, right? That's pretty tiny. But you've got a mass of 1.5 to 3 solar masses in there, which gives you a density of 6 × 10^14 times that of water, which is really quite high. Basically, you're looking at neutrons. If you imagine what sort of the density of an atomic nucleus would be, things that are sort of packed together, protons and neutrons, you're getting close to that with this. And I think that that's one of the homework problems in this upcoming set that's due, is asking you to compare what the actual density of the atomic nucleus is and compare it to this number. Because of the amount of mass we have here and because of the relative size of the neutron star, that means that they have escape velocities that are really pretty high. It's hard to get light off of the surface of these. So the escape velocity is 60% the speed of light. So if you were ended up on a neutron star somehow, you would have pretty much no chance of getting off of it, with current technology anyway. They have a pretty weird structure. We actually don't know much about what the inside of a neutron star really looks like, because down at the very bottom, the very center of the neutron star, it probably has conditions, pressures, things that we really have no idea how that works. We can't replicate that in a lab. So we don't really know what it looks like, but we can sort of get a better idea of what the surface looks like, or the outer layers at least. There's an outer crust. There's this diagram down here in the corner. An outer crust, which is composed of iron and neutron-rich element isotopes and lots of electrons. this inner crust here. So that's sort of, they're giving sort of a little bit of a scale here. So the outer crust is like 0.3 kilometers thick. And then the inner crust is like 0.6 kilometers thick. The inner crust has some elements in it, sort of the same mix of iron and neutron-rich isotopes, but it's also got what we would call a neutron superfluid. Which is basically just a way of saying that there's too much pressure for this to form any sort of definitive solid structure, right? So it's just sort of a soup of neutrons that have, you know, that are getting close to, you know, they're in the degenerate state, they're in the neutron degeneracy pressure. It's just a real mess. And then the interior probably is that same neutron superfluid, but as you get closer down to the core of the neutron star, it's really hard to say what's going on. The really interesting thing about neutron stars is that because of that outer crust that contains all those electrons, they have really, really, really strong magnetic fields. So if we compare the magnetic field strength of some typical comparison thing. So the Earth has a magnetic field strength, where B is talking about magnetic fields, right? Earth's magnetic field strength is 1/2 Gauss, where Gauss is a measure of magnetic field strength. I think there's also Teslas and something else. But this is the one that gives sort of human scale units for the Earth, 1/2 Gauss. The sun's magnetic field is about somewhere between 1 and 10 Gauss, depending on where it is in the solar activity cycle, whether you have lots of magnetic field lines or not. A neutron star's magnetic field strength is 10 to the 14 Gauss. So again, we are really vastly outpacing the normal values that we would expect to see for such things out in the universe. It's high, it's big. They're also really hot, temperature-wise. Remember, they're the core of a very massive star that's left over. They are going to start out somewhere around 10 to the 11 Kelvin, right immediately after the supernova, and over time they will sort of cool down, and so sort of after some amount of time they'll get down to about 1,000,000 Kelvin. That's probably sort of the coldest neutron star that we've observed to date. So that's the lower bound of what's observed, but obviously they can keep cooling over time. That's like a white dwarf. We talked about those cool over trillions of years. These are also going to cool over very long periods of time. But so this combination, right, of high temperature, lots of electrons, there's other neutron-rich elements in there, iron, stuff in there floating around. This is an environment ripe for charged particles. And so when you have lots of charged particles in a strong magnetic field, that generates lots of radiation because you have these charged particles spinning around magnetic field lines, they're accelerating, they're putting off high energy photons, things, gamma rays, X-rays, ultraviolet light, all coming out of this neutron star. Specifically, this type of radiation is called synchrotron radiation. Synchrotron. And this is when you get the acceleration of charged particles around magnetic field lines. This is not a phenomenon that's limited to neutron stars by any means. This happens all over the place, but it's the particular temperature and quantity of the synchrotron radiation that's important here. They're very bright in the short wavelength part of the spectrum, and they're hot enough that the black body radiation curve for a neutron star peaks in the X-ray part of the spectrum. So if you go back and put them on an HR diagram, sort of imagine where white dwarfs are down on the corner, you're going to keep moving down diagonally to the left. They're going to be really hot, really small, and not very bright overall, but they're going to be bright in that X-ray part of the spectrum. One last really important thing about a neutron star is that as the progenitor star, the supernova, collapses down, remember that stars are rotating the same way planets are, right? The sun spins at like 30, once per 30 days or so. So you can imagine the entire star is spinning at some level, right? There's some amount of angular momentum in the sun. As that core collapses down to a smaller size, remember it collapses by a factor of like 10,000 in size or more, it's going to conserve that angular momentum as it collapses down. So neutron stars end up spinning really, really fast, on the order of thousands of hertz sometimes. And they can slowly spin down over time. They can slow down how fast they spin. But they're all going to be spinning at least some amount quite quickly, right? Sort of on the order of periods of seconds to minutes, fractions of a second. And this in combination with the magnetic field means that you will have basically what we would call a lighthouse effect from this neutron star. All this light, as being these charged particles that are being emitted off of the neutron star, are going to be emitted along the magnetic field lines that are part of the strong magnetic field of the neutron star. So that basically makes it look something like this. So here's a diagram. You have the neutron star spinning around this axis here, but the magnetic field is this sort of double-lobed ear shape around the neutron star. And the idea here is that the magnetic axis, which is this other line here, it points along. The same way the Earth's magnetic field is not aligned to its spin, right? The magnetic north is a little bit off of true north on the Earth. The same thing can apply to a neutron star, right? The orientation of that magnetic field is essentially random. It could be up, it could be down, it could be left, right, anywhere in between. And so these magnetic field lines, any charged particle that's emitted on either half here will just be captured by a magnetic field line and drawn back into the neutron star. But anything coming out of a pole will be able to make it further out, and so it sort of makes a directed beam of light out of the poles of that neutron star. But that neutron star is spinning. So you can imagine if you're along this line of sight, along this beam of light coming out, as that neutron star spins, you would sort of see it blinking on and off as it points at you, rotates away, points at you again, rotates away, points at you. And that produces this sort of blinking lighthouse effect. These are called pulsars because they pulse, right? They flash. They have periods of somewhere between usually 0.25 and 2 seconds. And these are really interesting things to look at out in the sky, because originally, first sort of pulsar we observed, we didn't know what it was. Like, what is this thing, right? And so it took a few years to sort of settle on this idea of a fast rotating neutron star being the correct model for this. But these are sort of scattered all around in the sky. We don't necessarily see everyone that's out there, right? Because you just have to be aligned with the jet of light coming out. So if you aren't along that line of sight, you're not going to see the pulsar. Not flashing, anyway. You could see a neutron star out there, but you wouldn't necessarily see it flashing. So these pulsars are sort of really useful for establishing sort of three-dimensional positions in the galaxy. Right? You can sort of map out, oh, this pulsar is over here. You could say they all have sort of unique periods, right? They're not necessarily all going to be 2 seconds or 0.25, but they'll have 0.2675, 0.3272 sort of things. And so you can uniquely identify pulsars by their position and period of rotation, and so you can sort of assemble a 3D grid of where they are out in the sky, and that can help you sort of navigate around in a 3D way in the galaxy. If you map out where the pulsars are, you can look back and see them in a different direction. As those, there's that one, there's that one, there's that one. You can triangulate your position based on that. Sort of a common sci-fi trope there, how you navigate around the galaxy.
That's what we put on the Voyager and the Pioneer plaques, is our location in reference to like 8 pulsars. So if aliens come across those satellite missions, they can find out where it came from.
If those aliens know those same 8 pulsars, they can find, here's where you are, where these pulsars are in this particular position in the sky. They can basically an address. So if aliens show up tomorrow, blame the Voyager holder record. These neutron stars, they're weird objects, right? These are fast spinning, high strength magnetic fields, really hot, really dense. This sort of represents the extreme of what we can see out there in terms of the products of stellar evolution over time. Of course, that leaves out the things that we can't see that are the products of stellar evolution over time, and those are black holes, right? Why are they called black holes? Talk about it for a minute.
Stars, they are discovered because they have these regular pulses of radiation. When we first discovered them, the first one was labeled LGM-1 or Little Green Man. And the person who discovered it was a graduate student named Jocelyn Bell. Now she's married, Jocelyn Bell Brunel. And she discovered pulsars. And instead of her, her thesis advisor won the Nobel Prize.
Boo.
But she's very, like, gracious about it. She talked to her. She's still alive. She talked to her. She's like, yeah, he deserves the Nobel Prize. But everyone in the astronomy community is like, no, you need the prize.
Yet again, Garrett's divine device applies to that one. Why are they called black holes? I heard somebody say it. What was it?
The escape velocity of the object is Right.
So a black hole is black because light cannot escape from it, right? So we said for a neutron star, the escape velocity is like 6/10 the speed of light. For a black hole, it's the speed of light, precisely the speed of light. We'll talk about why it's precisely the speed of light in a second. But here is a picture of a black hole. You probably have seen this picture before, yes? This is fairly recent. This is from just a few years ago. It's like something out of Lord of the Rings or something, or the fiery eye. Is that too nerdy a reference for you? What part of this is the actual black hole that we're talking about?
So the bright like orange part of it is the light that's being like sucked into it, so it'd be the center of it.
Yeah. So it's just this part in here, right? Yeah. Right. So we are seeing right this dark part, the shadow here in the middle, that's the actual part that it contains all the mass here. And then the glowing part around it is what we call the accretion disk around the black hole. So this is hot material that's being pulled, basically pulled in, and as it gets pulled in, forms into a disk because of the conservation of angular momentum, and it's just bumping into itself over and over again, and it heats up because of all the bumpy interactions that are happening. And so you see a glow from the hot material around that in that disk. But there's also sort of like a lensing effects happening here. There's a model that they talk about in the, this is more of a, this particular one is more of a 222 topic because this is a supermassive black hole. This is the central black hole in a very massive elliptical galaxy in the Virgo cluster. Do we have a picture of that somewhere? It's one of those over there in that M87, so somewhere like sort of 2/3 of the way down, 3/4 of the way down in that Messier object poster over there. It's one of the round looking ones, but this is an extremely massive black hole. This is millions, billions of solar masses of mass in this. Black holes from supernova are gonna be in sort of the 3 to 10 solar mass range, not even remotely this big. We were able to photograph this one because it's so large that it's big enough to be resolved with a telescope the size of the Earth. So this is where they did some interferometry. They took radio telescopes on opposite sides of the Earth and combined data to get resolution high enough to actually see this one.
For context on how big this black hole is, you know, the Voyager spacecraft has left the solar system. You put the solar system there, Voyager has just entered the light part on that image.
Right. This thing is huge. And yet it's not huge, because black holes are weird. We'll talk about that again in a second. So the mass of a stellar mass black hole is going to be, right, like I said, between 3 and 10 solar masses. That 3 lower limit there is the upper limit of the size of a neutron star, right? That's about where neutron degeneracy can't support the star anymore, and so anything above that, it can't support itself against collapse, and it collapses down into a black hole instead. So you're gonna get stellar mass black holes like this out of really massive stars, right? So you can imagine anything above 8 solar masses can become a supernova. And so in that range, right, sort of 8 to 15, you'll make a neutron star. 15 and above, you'll make a black hole. You can sort of imagine it that way. So these are formed black holes. Stellar mass black holes are formed by the core collapse in the supernova. Black holes only really have a few properties to them. They have mass, right? That's when we can measure by observing orbits around it or something. They also have spin, like quantum mechanical spin, like an electron can be up or down kind of thing. And they have, in theory, electric charge. Because they're made of charged particles in some way, and so you get to conserve electric charge. So things cancel out, they may be positively or negatively charged depending on what goes into it. And then they have what we would describe as a size, in quotes. It's not really a size, but it's a size. Because what we're really seeing here is we would call this a singularity, is what a black hole really is. Because there's nothing to prevent the mass from collapsing down in on itself, it goes in as far as it can to an infinitely small space. In a black hole, there's nothing keeping things from occupying the same space, so it occupies the same space. So if you can imagine sort of a topological map, right, have an XY axis, a black hole would be the size of the intersection of the two axes. It would be the origin point, that's what the actual object is, right? It does not have a size. But it does have a size, quotes, because we can measure, based on the mass of the black hole, at what radius away from that singularity the escape velocity is the speed of light. So if we go back to the definition of escape velocity, that's equal to the escape velocity squared is equal to 2 times the constant g times the mass divided by the radius that you're at. If you set the escape velocity equal to the speed of light here, so 2gm over r equals c squared, you can solve for the radius based on what that mass is, and you get that the radius is equal to 2gm over c squared. So this is something called the Schwarzschild radius. I can never spell it right. And this is when you hear someone refer to the size of a black hole, this is what they are referring to. It's the radius from the singularity at which the escape velocity is the speed of light. So outside that radius, light can still get out, right? Because light travels at the speed of light. If it goes inside that radius, it cannot get out anymore, right? So that's where you see that donut shape, right? If you're inside that radius, there's no longer light that can be emitted. If you look closely, there's a little bit of orange on top of the shadow part. That's just because of stuff in front along the line of sight can make it out, but really the donut sort of is like a two-dimensional projection of that. And also there's crazy lensing effects going on here too. If you've seen the movie Interstellar, right, it's kind of that weird thing going on. That's a spoiler, I'm sorry. That's sort of what's going on here. It's just this is low resolution. David.
And they also, Interstellar came out before this photo was taken,
yep.
So that was like a guess.
Yeah, they did pretty well. They hired a physicist, so
yeah,
you kind of figure they're going to get it at least pretty close.
Also, the general question: why is it a ring of light instead of like entire sphere around the entire thing?
Because so things, we'll talk about this when we talk about star formation too. But when things collapse down, they go from big to small. You start out with a sphere and it collapses down small. They become disks because of the conservation of angular momentum. So you always have your sort of outward centripetal force, but you lose your up and down motion. So as you know, if you're sort of imagine moving through the solar system perpendicular, right, motion that way, you can lose energy in that direction. And so things flatten out, they settle down as things collide in a vertical motion way, but they can't lose any of the momentum going in or out. So things that, as they collapse down, you spin the disc, but you can't spin the disc up and down, right? You can't puff it up the same way, and so it flattens out. And so it's not a sphere, it's a disc instead. But really what we're seeing here is we're probably seeing this more or less ish edge on, but the lensing effects are making it look weird that you're sort of seeing it tilted. I don't actually know what the orientation is here, but that's sort of the idea behind the fainter arc over the top is light bending around over top of the black hole you're seeing on the other side.
Yeah.
Very weird stuff. So this is a supermassive black hole, billions of solar masses. We're talking about stellar mass black holes. How might we actually observe that these exist out in the universe? What is going to be a way that we actually can tell that there's something there, right? They're black. You can't see them, but there's mass there. So take a minute, talk about it. How would you actually confirm the existence of a black hole that can't have an accretion disk like this? How are you going to figure out that it's there? Their next target is ours. But they have to do a lot better on the single dish size to be able to do it.
Would it be hard to image the our own supermassive black hole? Because we're like, we'd be looking in like from the edge almost. And so there'd be a lot of like things in between.
We're gonna really get into the weeds on that. 6 months, right? It's called extinction. Right? If you look through the disk of the galaxy, all the light gets absorbed along the line of sight by dust and gas and stuff.
Yeah.
But for stuff like this, this is usually on the radio part of the spectrum that we're observing this.
Gosh, yeah.
And radio light is absorbed way less than visible light. So you can actually pretty well see the center of the galaxy in radio. It's just that really the issue is the size of it.
I guess that like this has been the one that we've looked at because we're looking at it like from the plane of our galaxy, we're like looking like away, like towards another one.
Yeah.
But that's
yeah.
not necessarily true. It's like actually it could just be anywhere. It was just the
right.
best
yeah.
candidate. Okay.
Extinction is a massive problem. Right? So anything you want to observe in that's in sort of anywhere close to the plane of the galaxy, you have to really take that into account.
Yeah.
And so I think Virgo cluster is fairly far away from the galactic plane, right? If you look, there's an edge on, that's the Milky Way back there in the back, right? It's sort of up in the darker part of the left-hand panel, sort of up in the top half of that. So you're not really looking through lots of dust to see it. But looking toward the middle, which is the bright part on the right-hand panel, that's there's lots of dust, right? You can see the black streak that goes in front of it. So how would you observe a black hole that's not able to have an accretion disk? What did you come up with? Garrett?
Like look for previously like unexplained bits of like planets or other bodies in the region, if you know something that it's being affected by the gravity of
you're going to look for that black hole's effect on the things around it, basically, right? So if you can imagine you're looking out,
at, you see some star, and it's just sort of doing this for no reason, it's probably orbiting around something that you can't see. Right, and you can measure how long you think that orbit is, you can measure the mass for it, and then, oh, hey, look, it's like five solar masses, but I can't see anything there. Probably a black hole. Right? So that's basically how you have to do it. You have to look for that black hole's effect on other stuff. So we'll see that again when we talk about the Milky Way supermassive black hole. That's how we discovered it. We were looking at orbits of stars in the center of the galaxy, and it was like, hey, these are all orbiting around something that's not there. So, gotta be something there. That's sort of the extent that we'll talk about black holes. Just, they're cool, and we have to mention them, but they're sort of mysterious things, and they come up a lot more in galaxy scale than they do in stellar scale. There's going to be tons of them floating around there. One thing you should know, just to be clear, if the sun became a black hole, we would be fine, apart from the whole light and heat thing. But we're not going to get sucked in, because it would still be one solar mass, and we'd have the same orbit we always do. It would just get real cold real fast. So maybe that's a solution to global warming, is we just turn off the sun by making it a black hole. And everything gets freezing cold again.
But our sun won't become a black hole.
It won't, no. But, you know, if you imagine some, like, sci-fi supervillain shit, you know?
Instead, the opposite is going to happen. It's going to get real hot real fast.
Yeah. what I want to do now is return to the white dwarf. Because this is also, you know, sort of in the same vein. It's a compact, dense object. But white dwarfs are also involved in the other kind of supernova that we mentioned the other day, right? So we talked about core collapse supernova. Those are type 2 supernova,
which have a light curve that sort of flattens out and then decays after a longer period of time because of the radioactive decay processes. But then there's type 1a supernova, which fade sooner and more rapidly than the type 2s do.
So I wanted to talk about that and talk about what process actually is happening there to cause that other kind of supernova. So just a quick recap of what white dwarfs are. They're the leftover cores of sort of sun-like stars, right? They're the fusion product of helium to carbon and oxygen that cannot get hot enough to turn on carbon-oxygen fusion. They're primarily composed, most white dwarfs we know about are composed of carbon and oxygen, but there are also helium white dwarfs out there.
What's going to be the difference in the mass of the star that produced a carbon-oxygen white dwarf versus a helium white dwarf? The helium will be an even lower mass original star, right? The same way the sun doesn't get hot enough to produce heavier elements out of carbon, even lower mass stars, like 10th of a solar mass stars, don't get hot enough to make carbon out of helium. And so they'll end up with a helium white dwarf instead in the end.
Those are more rare because those stars have longer main sequence lifetimes, and so we haven't had them around long enough to make lots of helium white dwarfs. We talked about how main sequence lifetimes get shorter as you get more massive. They also get longer as you get less massive, right? So I think like the lowest mass main sequence star has like a trillion year main sequence lifetime or something. So, white dwarfs are typically going to be masses around one solar mass, have luminosities about 3% that of the sun. So 0.03 solar luminosities. But they'll have temperatures sort of averaging around 27,000 Kelvin. So if we go back, we remember what the luminosity equation is, right? Luminosity is equal to 4 pi r squared sigma t to the fourth. If we're hotter than the sun, if we're way less luminous, but a lot hotter, that means that this has to be really small, right? Radius has to be really tiny. So the radius of a white dwarf is going to be around 0.008 times that of the sun, which is about the same size as Earth, give or take a few percent. So if you write neutron star is the size of New York City-ish, white dwarf is the size of Earth roughly, right? You can sort of get a good analogous size there. So they do have very high densities, not nearly as high as a neutron star, but still high, right? That's going to be about 3 million grams per cubic centimeter. And they are, of course, supported by electron degeneracy pressure rather than neutron degeneracy pressure. Because of that, they also have a maximum mass that they can be. And so if you dig into the physics, you look and you say, okay, you know, here's what the radius is, here's what the density is, here's what the mass is. If you start turning that mass knob up and finding what the electron degeneracy pressure has to be to keep it supported, when you get to 1.44 solar masses, you can no longer support the star by electron degeneracy pressure, and above that mass you cannot have a white dwarf anymore. This is called the Chandrasekhar limit. And that three-ish solar mass limit for what a neutron star is sort of the same idea, just for neutron degeneracy pressure. This is an important limit to think about, because sometimes you can get white dwarfs. Oh, did I do it again? I did it again. Sometimes you can get white dwarfs in binary systems with stars that are getting really big. And when that happens, you can start to pull material off of the red giant star into an accretion disk around the white dwarf. And you start adding mass to the white dwarf, which isn't going to end well when you have a maximum mass. This doesn't necessarily have to be a total catastrophe. It can just be a minor catastrophe. You can have something called a regular old nova versus a supernova, right? A nova is when that accretion disk gets hot enough to do spontaneous hydrogen to helium fusion in the accretion disk. So you do a burst of fusion in that hot disk and turn it into helium that settles onto the white dwarf star, or gets blown away or something. because it doesn't destroy the white dwarf star, you can have that nova repeat on sort of a shortish time scale. And those are some things called recurrent nova, where you can sort of say, okay, it takes, you know, 4 years or whatever to build up the same amount of material that you needed to get to the right temperature to do that fusion. And you can watch and you can sort of repeat, and they sort of are relatively regular repeating flashes nova out in a white dwarf binary system. Those are fairly common. I don't know that they're necessarily bright enough to see with the naked eye or anything, but there's probably one that you could probably see if you look it up, though. What do you imagine is going to happen as you know, sort of these novas aren't happening particularly close to that limit of 1.44 solar masses? What do you imagine is going to happen when you approach that limit in this white dwarf star? Talk about it for a second. What do you think, Nathaniel?
It will shrink down a lot and turn into a neutron star.
That's sort of the broad, you know, slap some paint on the canvas answer, right? You know, you're saying, okay, we can't support the star by electron and degeneracy pressure anymore. We add too much mass, so it shrinks down and becomes a neutron star. But that rapid change, right? The same thing that happened in the core of a massive star. You have to go from big to small really fast, and so it sort of bounces and explodes. Right? That's sort of what's happening here. There's a little bit more nuance, though, because the real process that happens is that somewhere around 1.3 solar masses, as you're getting close-ish to that limit, right, at 1.3 solar masses, this star gets hot enough, this white dwarf, it's not really a star, but the white dwarf gets hot enough to start doing carbon fusion. Remember that you have sort of the conditions of the core of a massive star here, right? It's roughly the same size of the core of a massive star. It's going to sort of get into that same regime. At 1.3 solar masses, you start doing carbon fusion, carbon burning, and you have basically a big blob of carbon there, ripe to be fused. And you sort of go through all the steps there that you would go through in the core of a massive star until you get to iron. Very quickly, you go through all those steps. And then you try to do iron fusion, and the same way that it happened in a core collapse supernova, it doesn't work. And so it does the same thing, right? It collapses down into a neutron star, rebounds, and explodes. But you don't have outer layers anymore on this white dwarf, right? You don't have an envelope of hydrogen to hide some of the light from that. So this is just as bright as the neutron star rebound thing that happens in a core collapse supernova, just with nothing to stop the light from getting out. There's no outer layer to expand out, right? So you just see the raw collapse energy. And so you get a luminosity more than a billion solar luminosities in the space of, you know, a few days here as this process happens. The difference between a type 1A, we'll call this a thermal runaway supernova versus a core collapse supernova. The difference between a thermal runaway and a core collapse supernova is that there's no remnant left over after a white dwarf supernova explosion. It just sort of vaporizes away. You might have the companion star be left over, but no more white dwarf. David?
This is a little off topic, but going back to neutron star formation, so there's an electron degeneration compression, and it becomes so great gravity supersedes that, and then it contracts really fast, and then it bounces off the neutron mm-hmm. energy pressure, then it injects a ton of mass.
Yeah.
Can that mass that's injected ever make it so the gravity or pressure, hydrostatic equilibrium, is less, or yeah, the gravity, it makes it so the pressure isn't as great as required to surpass electron degeneracy. So, but what I'm saying is, like, can that supernova make it so it's not a neutron star because of the amount of mass that was ejected from it?
I think I see what you're saying. So you're saying you don't make a neutron star, but you do something else?
Well, yeah, so it still bounces because of the neutron degeneracy, but so much matter was ejected that it doesn't become a neutron star. It goes back to, is that possible, or is it that it once it's so massive, it doesn't eject?
I don't think so, because you have to, it's hard to return the star to a stable state after you've turned off all the fusion and then bounced it. There's not much there to establish a stable process anymore in terms of fusion, if that's what you're asking.
Yeah, I think so. So once it starts that process, it's not reversible, it can't go back to...
I don't think you can do anything less extreme. Go more extreme, you could just go straight to a black hole and have nothing get blown out at all if you're
right.
Massive enough. It just all collapses down.
Yeah, but going the other way is really tough.
But going the other way is probably impossible.
Okay.
At least in my understanding of the physics. Yeah. Here.
So you said with this type of supernova, there's nothing left after it.
Right.
Supernova, it just blasts everything out to some sort of dispersion area.
Right.
And
so if you've got a red giant close by, it would affect that probably. You might see it blow away some outer layers of the atmosphere, but the actual explosion itself, there's no remnant of that.
Gotcha.
Like the neutron star is left over in the middle of where the white dwarf is left over in the middle of the planetary nebula. Yeah. Go ahead, did you have a question?
Yeah, I was
going to
ask, so there's nothing left if there's no neutron star.
Albert. Say that a little bit louder, Albert.
Is the
Yeah, so that material will end up out in the universe, right? This is where most of the heavy elements in stuff comes from, right? Like Earth, you know, those heavier elements. If we go back, I mean, look at that periodic table chart we were talking about.
right? Exploding white dwarfs. That's the white pixels on this, right? So all this stuff, that's predominantly coming from white dwarf explosions, right? So you're making all these things in that runaway fusion process that's happening, where you go through carbon, oxygen, iron, all that stuff. All those steps are coming out of this here. Was that your question, Albert? So you're sort of asking what phase of matter it comes out in. I hesitate to fall back on the solid, liquid, gas, like, you know, because things are weird when they're ionized. But I would say it's probably going to start out as gas and then cool into little rocks, basically. That's my really basic back of the envelope guess. I'm not sure. But that's my guess. I'll find out, though. Yeah. It's going to end up, though, in our next topic. We're going to talk about the interstellar medium, right? So we'll get there in a second, unless there's any other questions about the type 1A supernova. No. Okay. Cool. All right, so we're going to switch gears. We've been talking about really dense things, right? Black holes, neutron stars, white dwarfs, cores of stars. It's time to shift and start talking about really low density things, right? This begins our journey in the formation of a star, something called the interstellar medium, which literally means stuff between the stars. What is, in your educated guess, based on what we've learned so far in this class, what is the main component of the interstellar medium? What is it made out of, element-wise? Sort of rough composition. Talk about it for a second. What's it made out of?
Hydrogen.
What?
Hydrogen.
Hydrogen. Mostly. About 75% hydrogen. What's the rest, Mark?
Helium.
About 24%. You can probably guess what the rest is, right?
Ether.
Everything. Get out. Everything else, right? So, you know, it's going to be things like different molecular gases, you know, carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, water. Cyanide gas, all sorts of stuff, right? So things like, we'll call it molecular gases. And then something called dust, which together make up less than about 1% of the rest of the interstellar medium. So when we think about what we can see, right? If you sort of look at, go back to look at the picture of the Milky Way in the back of the classroom again, right? There's dark streaks in front of the stars that you can see. You look at the other one there with the pillars of creation over there in the other corner, right? That's more or less what we're talking about here, right? That's the interstellar medium. What you're mostly seeing in this, these sort of visible optical parts of the spectrum, the dark streaks, the weird tendril shapes in that other picture, that stuff is dust, primarily, right? The dark shapes that you can't really get a good handle on what the shape is, that's dust. And then in that particular picture back there, right, there's sort of a blue glow behind it, and then there's an upper inset with a lot of red light coming out. Is Ray going to bring it up front so we can see it? Up there, yeah. Right, that's emission line spectra from the hydrogen gas that's out, that's in that clump of stuff out in the interstellar medium. So obviously, hydrogen is the biggest component here. That's going to end up being arguably the most important part of the interstellar medium. That's good because it's the biggest part of it, right? Because what does this composition roughly look like to you? It's about the same as the sun, right? The sun was like 70-24-2-ish, right? So this is sort of roughly in the same ballpark as the sun. That's interesting because the sun formed out of gas just like this broad composition of the interstellar medium. So we have to talk, let's start by talking about the different forms of hydrogen that are in the, we'll call it the ISM is the sort of the acronym that we'll use here. The first one of these is what we call neutral hydrogen. And we'll write this in shorthand with H Roman numeral 1, like this. Where this one, I think Ray talked about this in his lecture when we talked about the HR diagram. The Roman numeral here refers to the ionization state of that. And so H1 is neutral hydrogen, so it's in the ground state. H2 would be singly ionized. H3 would be doubly ionized, but there's only one electron in a hydrogen. You can't doubly ionize. That leaves us with, again, ionized hydrogen, right? Which is H2. And then molecular hydrogen, which is also pronounced H2, but it's H subscript numeral 2, not Roman numeral 2. So that's two hydrogens stuck together in a molecule, sharing a whatever kind of bond. Is it ionic or covalent, Ray? Do you remember? Yeah.
I'm not against.
You're asking, you're talking to two people who have, probably haven't taken chemistry since high school, so. AP credit. How are we going to see this hydrogen out there in the interstellar medium? What are going to be the ways that we can actually see it, like observe that it's there, right? It's invisible light. It's essentially invisible, right? You could see through it, more or less. So what's going to be the different ways that we can see it? Talk about it for a second. Think back to some of the spectra stuff we talked about earlier in the class.
Yeah.
Okay, you seem sure of this one. You got quiet fast. David.
Is it Kirchhoff's third law?
Which is what?
So you have a continuous spectrum, and then you have a fluid fused gas. And you're going to, when you read that, you're going to get dark spectral lines on whichever wavelength of the element that you're.
Yeah. So you could do that in theory, right? You could say there's a star behind that's providing a continuous spectrum. And if you have hydrogen gas in front of it, neutral hydrogen gas, you'd see the absorption lines as the electron moves up. What's the problem with that technique? Garrett? Right. Stars that have compositions like the sun's have hydrogen absorption lines in their spectra already. So that's not going to be a particularly... What if there's more hydrogen in the star than there is in the foreground? You won't be able to measure how much of the moon is there. Basically, right?
But it's a good idea. If you had a star without hydrogen absorption lines somehow, you could do it. But those are usually... have really messy spectrums. You saw in the H.R. Niagara class. You could do that, but those are pretty sparsely populated, and they're also faint. What about emission spectra? Can some of the hydrogen glow on its own at all? Garrett says yes. Why? Electrons are going to be moving around in those orbitals, right? You're going to be bouncing around. You're going to be absorbing and emitting light at sort of random wavelengths. But that's going to be relatively rare. It's going to be relatively faint. So you're not going to... So neutral hydrogen, sort of sitting there with an electron in it already, is not really going to give you very much light out of it. It's going to be hard to see in the optical part of the spectrum. It would give off light, but... it'd be tough to see above the background level of light that you're seeing. Ionized hydrogen, though, you can have chance recombinations of electrons with hydrogen atoms, and those will sort of cascade down, and you'll get Balmer line emission. Remember, that's sort of the red color,
red and sort of palish green color. Those are back in that picture. The trick here, though, with ionized hydrogen is that it exists in relatively warm environments. You need it to be hot to get the electrons out for it to be ionized. So we're sort of talking thousands of Kelvin here. So it's going to be pretty hot. That means to be that hot, it either has to be really dense or close to something hot. What are the things that are out in the galaxy that are particularly hot that it would have to be close to? Stars, probably, right? In particular, massive stars are really hot, right? 30,000 Kelvin surface temperature. So those stars also have very short lifetimes. The more massive they get, the shorter their life, which means that they must have formed recently. So if we look out and we see Balmer line emission from ionized hydrogen, it's probably a sign that the stars nearby formed relatively recently. Because massive stars, hot massive stars, have short main sequence lifetimes. So ionized hydrogen you see in Balmer line emission spectra. And it is a tracer for recent star formation. If you see it, it probably is nearby stars that formed recently. Neutral hydrogen is harder to see in the optical, right? We talked about that already, right? So it's sort of, you just sort of have random transitions happening. That comes in cold environments. So we're talking hundreds or less Kelvin. And because you're in a cold environment, mostly the electrons in that neutral hydrogen are going to be in the ground state, which means that they're only going to be doing absorbing upwards instead of emission downwards. Luckily, there is a, what's the right word? Degeneracy? That's not the right word. There is a I guess degeneracy is the closest word I can think of. The ground state and a neutral hydrogen atom actually splits into two separate states based on what the spin of the electron and proton do. So the proton, I'm going to stop because this is not going to be able to be explained in 2 minutes. So we're going to leave it there and come back to it on Monday. We'll talk about neutral hydrogen again on Monday. Have a good weekend. Don't forget, there's homework due in a week and a half on the 15th. I am, because we didn't get to it again, still, I'm going to delay the Python homework again by at least 1 week. So stay tuned for a new due date on that one. But the rest of it will be due on that Monday the 15th still. The book problems still due the 15th, because we actually have covered all of that now, I think, so. Just four. Five is just Python.